Tanya Page is a journalist currently working with TVNZ's flagship current affairs show, Sunday. Earlier in her career, she was on the team that launched the 24-hour news channel, Al Jazeera English. In this episode, she shares her career journey, working in news media around the world, and talks to us about some of the heart-wrenching stories she's had to cover in her time as a journalist. Whakarongo mai. Kia ora, I'm Kiane. Nuku is a movement. We're empowering Indigenous wahine to be agents of change, cultivating opportunities to shape the world we want. Through this series, we're meeting 100 kick-ass Indigenous wahine doing things differently. They show us how the world can be shaped by our unique Indigenous voice. It's all about who we are and not who we've been told to be. Nuku, mahine, mohine, kiahine. Kia ora te whānau and welcome back to another episode of Nuku. Today we have the wonderful Tanya Page. Tēnā koe.
Tēnā koe.
How has your day been today? It's the crack of dawn on a Monday morning.
Long so far. I'm an early riser, so I was up at about 5:30, walked my two dogs, walked around in circles waiting for this. I hate being late, so I was like, you know, quite nervous about this as well. So I've been to the wharepaku about 3 times already. And now here we are.
Now, that makes me laugh that you say you're nervous, because this is your job.
No, it's not. Asking questions is my job. Answering the questions is always somebody else's job.
Being in this space, you know. We're going to talk a little bit about your job and the amazing career that you've had and doing the mahi that you do. But as always, we start with a bit about who you are and where you're from. So, ko wai koe, no hia koe.
Ka pai. Ko Pūwhiki tōku maunga, ko Ngāti Kahu Rawa, ko Ngaitahu Oku Iwi, ko te whānau moana tōku hapu, ko Haiti Tai Marangai tōku marae. No Tokerau, ahau, engari I grew up in a small town in Te Tai Tokerau called Northland. And yeah, my name is Tanya. That's ki te tau o tōku māma, but also Yugoslav on her side. So her maiden name was Ehrlich, and on my father's side is English and Irish. So
wow,
a real jumble.
So grew up in Moirewa.
Aye.
Where, no, not where, because Moirewa is very tiny.
It's pretty small.
How and what was it like growing up in such a small little town that most people just drive through?
Yeah. I mean, highs and lows, I'll be honest with you. I mean, we don't have whānau in Moirewa, so I kind of miss that side of a childhood, although we were always going up to Tokerau, Karikari Peninsula, where my mum's whānau is from. Mm. I loved Moirewa, and it was only through exposure to people from outside of Moirewa that you kind of got a glimpse as to how some other people saw it or see it, you know, and you kind of think, oh, this is kind of happening a little bit. I don't know what's going on here, you know, because I used to, I was very fortunate in that my dad worked full time at the freezing works. He was there for about 40 years. And so there was a good regular income. And so my parents invested in us in terms of like extracurricular activities and some that were a little bit outside the box because neither of them are sporty. So we were always a little bit of like the oddball whānau in Moirewa because I went to ballet. You know, I did ballet for my entire childhood and we'd go to Kerikeri, which is like just up State Highway 1, 20 or so minutes. And that was like the flash place, you know. So I always had like other girls in those ballet lessons asking, so are there any nice houses in Moirewa?
Wow.
Yeah, so you kind of like, oh, this is kind of weird. So I kind of got used to sort of holding my space from quite a young age. But like an extraordinary community, Moirewa. Been through a lot of hard times, particularly since the 80s, you know, where there was like all these sort of Rogenomics and restructuring and the removal of some really important employment options for people. There was, you know, a bit of an issue around gangs and, but we were so young as kids, we weren't, you don't know what's going on. You just know that you're probably not supposed to go downtown and walk around the shops, you know.
Don't but, hang out at that person's house.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, why did you guys live in Moirua? Because if you were from Tokero,
yeah.
I mean, was there something in Moirua that...
The freezing works.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So my dad, my parents met in Auckland. They used to run a ballroom dancing studio in Auckland, and then they got pregnant with me, and it was like, right, I need a proper job. So Dad did this like whatever course to be a meat inspector, and then the way he tells it to me is that at that time there was this program in AFCO where if you did 5 years in either Moirua or somewhere down the line like Tikwiri or something like that, then after those 5 years you could choose where you went, and they were going to go to Nelson.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. But then a year after they moved to Moirua, they stopped that scheme, and so we just stayed. But, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
I grew to love it.
And I love that you've got... Ngāti Kahu Whakapapa and Ngāi Tahu Whakapapa. Because those are two pretty different parts of the country.
Opposite ends of the country. And it's interesting you asked that, actually, because recently we went down to Otipoti, Dunedin, to reconnect with that side, because my Nana's last, she was one of about 14, her last surviving brother still lives on the whenua out on Harrington Road, which is like Otago. Like you go down the road out to the Albatross Colony, mm-hmm. and it's Otago, Otago and Portobello. And then there's like a tohu and it says Otago. And from that point on is Māori land, and my Uncle Paul lives there.
How beautiful.
Oh, my goodness. So Nana was about 18 when, you know, there's 14 tamariki. They couldn't, you know, you can't stay at home forever. And she was sent up to Te Tai Tokero as a teacher's assistant, and then met my papa and fell in love and stayed, basically. So, yeah, we're connected from one end of the whenua to the other, which is kind of magical, I think.
Yeah. Mm. Growing up in small town Moirua, what did you see for your life? What was it that you wanted to be? Where did you want to go? Did you see yourself living there forever?
No, I didn't. And I think part of that was driven by some of that, the judgment of others, you know. It always, I guess, like, I don't know if this is my Dalmatian side or my Māori side or whatever, but my kind of fight or flight reflex is more along the fight side of things. It really pissed me off, frankly. Yeah. And I would have even friends or so-called friends at high school, you know, I don't know if we'll come to that party because I don't know how safe it's going to be, you know, if it was Moirua or Te Reo or something like that. And like, come on, man. Whereas some of the most giving, wonderful whānau are in spaces like real rural heartland New Zealand spaces like that. And it really annoyed me. And so I felt like this is not like where my whānau is, so I didn't have that tight a connection there. And just always felt really driven to see what else there was. And my parents, you know, I wouldn't, you know, they weren't kind of like pushing me to, you've got to go here and you've got to go to university and you've got to do this. They were kind of very trusting and sort of like quite a passive parenting style in that way, I suppose. They just allowed me the freedom to figure out what I wanted to do, and I eventually did, and then just kind of thought, well, no one's going to do this for me, you know. I better, like, you know, just get on with it. So I've always been driven, yeah.
What was the first sort of, do you remember what the first job you wanted to have was?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I wanted to be a marine biologist because I wanted to swim with the dolphins, right? Or like gorillas in the mist and like study gorillas. I mean, like I was like just infatuated by the natural world. And then I was at high school and realised that not only did you need biology, but you had to have chemistry or maths or something like that, and neither of those two things was going to be happening. So I kind of like drifted a little bit. I knew that I wanted to do something, but not what the thing was. And then this was back in the day before you were really like looking things up hard out on the internet.
before the internet existed. I remember when the internet came about.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. And there was a pamphlet for broadcasting school in Christchurch. And I just thought, this sounds really interesting and really practical because I'm a doer. I'm not going to go and do a master's or a PhD or anything like that. I want to see results immediately.
Yeah.
And so I thought that sounds like me, and that just set the path for me, basically. Yeah.
You went down to Christchurch and you were still quite young.
Yeah.
You're still in your late teens?
Yeah, I just turned 18. Yeah.
And it was down there that you also experienced racism.
Yeah, which is a shock, man. It's a shock when you're from Northland to have that introduced into your life. And the worst thing about it was the first day of... the worst thing about it was that it was the first day of broadcasting school, and it was an older student who's brown himself and said to me and like this other, the only other Māori in my year, so you guys must be the tokens this year. And it was just like, oh, dude. Like, I'm not sure what you're talking about, but also, like, wow. You know, if that sets the stage for your experience, first time you've left home, it's not very cool. And so that was very in your face for me at that time. And then the other things were just, like, I would get followed in shops and in, like, chemists, pharmacies, those sorts of things. Like, the worker would be there and then you'd go to the next aisle and then they'd also be there and then the next aisle and then they'd still be there. And it's like, you know, you're slow to click on because you're not used to it, you know. I mean, there's 9 out of 10, it feels like, in Moira anyway, are Māori. So to suddenly not be in what felt like the majority in Te Tai Tokiro was like, oh, this is out of it. I don't know about this. But again, for me, I just, like, it pissed me off.
Yeah.
You know, I thought, I'm not, what the, this is crazy.
Did it influence your drive within the industry, or did it influence what you thought you might want to tell stories on or about? Did it have any of that sort of influence on you?
It did, in the sense that I knew that I needed to hold my own space and that I was going to have to do that for myself, you know. Not at that time and the types of stories I wanted to do, because I think it's... I think when you feel like you're so outnumbered that the first step is just trying to make yourself or at least exude the confidence that you know you're supposed to be here. So it's like one battle at a time, basically, isn't it, before you win the war? So I always felt like that hanged over my experience at broadcasting school, that constant desire to have to prove that I was there because I was supposed to be. And other people don't have that experience, but I think all of those things amount to you ultimately feeling more confident about yourself and getting a thicker skin and being better, you know. And I take satisfaction from the fact that out of all the people that were in that journalism year, and some of them had already done degrees in political science, and I'm just like walked out of high school from Moira, I think I'm the only one who's still in journalism.
Wow.
Because I had to fight for it so hard, you know.
And I guess it prepared you for the industry.
Yeah, for sure. I mean,
it's not an easy industry to be in.
Oh, no.
Especially as a Māori woman.
It's like I like to make things hard for myself. Yeah, I mean, I kind of left broadcasting school really confident in the skills that were needed to do the job at a very junior entry level, but totally unprepared for the politics and the reality of a mainstream environment. So I went to TV3 as an intern and then basically refused to leave, so they had to give me a job in the end. Like,
I love
just
the strong willingness about you.
It just, when somebody says, or when there's that expectation that you can't do something, it just like, it makes me want to fight, you know, and I've always been like that. And so, yeah, but it was difficult because there was Gideon Porter was the Māori Affairs reporter at TV3 at the time. Yeah. So I got to see how he operated in that environment. And like, oh, you know, to be totally honest, it was not something like I feared that I was there because of being Māori. It was like I didn't see that at the time as being a strength. Actually, I thought that was to my detriment because I thought, oh man, if we're going to do all this again, I'm going to have to do all of these other things that I had to do to prove myself at broadcasting school. Mm. And then you have this realization that, well, you know what? I'm here because I love it. I'm here because I know I'll be good at this. And all that other stuff is other people's stuff. And I just have to be the better person and the better journo that I can in this space. But it's tricky. I mean, I remember the story with a woman called Andy Brotherston, and someone had graffitied the lighthouse at Cape Reinga. Mm. And this was back in the day before health and safety, right? And you're just like, let's go in a helicopter. And you're like, okay.
Hang out the helicopter.
and film. And yay! Like, I don't know what's happening. I'm terrified. And I got put in that helicopter because I'm Māori. And from Northland, I'm like, the chances of me actually finding a Māori I know at Cape Reinga is really slim. They're like, just go. And you're like, this is so bizarre. It's just a weird, it was weird, you know. And the funny thing was that we were at Cape Reinga and I did see a Māori that I knew.
Of course you did.
Of course you did. But yeah, It's a strange environment to be in, and you also are very cognizant and having to point out to people as well when they try and push you into, because Gideon eventually left, you know, and there was this gap in the Māori reporter's role because there can only be one, right? Mm. And I was being encouraged very strongly into that realm, and I fought. I said, I'm not going to do it. And I got pushback, obviously. It's like, well, you know, but, you know, you're here. And I'm like,
and you're Māori. Yeah. You should do all the Māori stories.
Yeah. And I had to explain, which is also, like, difficult as a 22-year-old to, like, an extremely experienced editorial bosses, that I'm not the right person for this because I wasn't raised in Te Ao Māori. I don't speak Māori. And they may not be important to you, but I think that's important in the Māori Affairs role. And inside me, although I didn't voice this, I was thinking, I don't feel like it's respectful to the kaupapa of Māori Affairs to just thrust this.
Young token Māori girl.
Yay! Here I am, everybody!
Yes, I get that. And it's something that happens to this day. It's
just so sad.
It's getting slightly better, but still happens so much to this day. And when I think about my early journalism careers, it was really funny because I didn't even want to work for, you know, Māori publications. Mm. So I'm not broadcast journalist, even though I've now become a broadcaster through Nuku.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. Just work on my enunciation through this podcast. But, you know, like I remember back then thinking I don't want to work for a Māori publication because I don't want to be pigeonholed as only being able to tell Māori stories. And it's really funny when you have that feeling because it's a feeling that is actually brought about by everyone else. Everyone else makes you feel that way. Yeah. So you're like, I don't want to be that. And then my first job was at Mana Magazine, so that kind of went out the window straight away. Well, you know, working for a mainstream organisation, and we think about mainstream media today, and I actually love that Hohepa from The Hori, I don't know if you know him, he's an artist down in Otaki. He has this sort of new campaign that he's running, that we are the mainstream.
Yeah, right.
And he talks about, you know, we are the awa, we are the moment, awesome. We are the mana, we are the mainstream. And I was like, oh, I love that. And which makes me feel really uncomfortable when I talk about mainstream media in the context of this corridor.
Yeah.
But, you know, when we think about mainstream media and we think about the systemic racism in mainstream, we think about the way mainstream channels report on stories, we think about the headlines, we think about the angles and all of that sort of stuff. Were you challenged at that young age to, I guess, not toe the line, but, you know, there's a way that producers and editors and directors want their stories told in a way that fits the narrative of their news program or their channel. How did you find your space in there, and were there some really challenging moments that were in that sort of
I'm trying to think back. Because it feels like an age ago now, you know. I don't recall any, no. I just remember feeling like, I think I had to channel so much of my energy into just trying to do what I thought was a good job in the best way possible and an authentic way to me. That, yeah, I don't know. Nothing springs to mind, yeah.
In 2015, you moved.
Yeah, big time.
And when we're talking about, you know, cutting your teeth at TV3 and cutting your teeth as a Māori journalist in New Zealand, you moved to London.
Yeah.
And you played a role in setting up Al Jazeera English, which is huge.
Yeah, it was massive.
What was that time like for you, and why did you choose to leave at that point?
I chose to leave because mainstream news is like ferocious and exhausting. And I felt like there was something else and I wanted to travel. And so my then boyfriend and I moved to the UK, and I was kind of, I thought, oh, you know, it'd be great if I can stay in journalism. And I was kind of introduced to people who were doing the interviews for Al Jazeera English and got this job. And then the channel wasn't on air for like 8 months. So we stood around and had these extraordinary conversations about what's Al Jazeera going to be and what kind of stories are we going to tell, and if we were on air now, what would it be like? And it was like complete like dreamland stuff. And you're sort of thinking, and people around me were like, this is never going to get off the ground. You know, it's never going to happen. So we've got to like, people left. People were hired and then they resigned before it even got on air because it took so long. But then 8 months later, launch, and I felt so privileged because it was this extraordinary kaupapa of, right, the narrative of the West and the South is a BBC or Sky or CNN. It's a very Western narrative on international broadcasting standards. So Al Jazeera's whole kaupapa was, let's rebalance and retell some of these same stories, but from a different global perspective. And I naturally felt at home, and it was kind of an awakening, actually, of my Māori tanga, because it's like, I belong here in this new thing so much more than I do at a Sky or a BBC or a CNN or an ITV, already very rigorously structured and worldview. I belong where there's a possibility of actually having an impact in these spaces. So, yeah, it was amazing.
What were some of the highlights of your time? Because you spent time in the UK.
Yeah.
And then you moved across to South Africa.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about some of the big stories you covered, but what were some of the highlights in the UK in those early days and some of the stories you were able to cover at that point?
Well, one that had the most impact on me really was that I, in the wake of Cyclone Nargis, which is in Myanmar, 2008, I think it was, we went in. And at that time, you know, we've seen Myanmar in the news quite a lot lately. It was some of the roots of what is happening today. You know, it's been a continuous process, basically, for that country. So at that time, the military junta was controlling the country, and they had... the cyclone had hit and devastated the country, which is like, it's called the Irrawaddy Delta. So it's really low lying, like rice paddies. It's quite estuarine tidal. So absolutely, like, and people live in huts, you know, so they were just wiped out. And we, and it's illegal to be a journalist in Myanmar. And you can't, you couldn't have a cell phone, or a cell phone was like the SIM cards were thousands of dollars. And so you had to use a satellite phone. And, you know, in places like that, the only people that have thousands of dollars or have satellite phones are connected to the government, which is the military. So we went, I went undercover, and I had to enter the country myself. And I swear I repacked my pack so many times because I was just going to pretend to be a tourist, which I could pull off, you know, and much more so than other kind of staff members in London. So I flew to Thailand and then over into Myanmar, and had the most terrifying but exhilarating week of my life. Walking through the streets by yourself, trying to have conversations with people. People want to talk, but they can't talk to you because there are spies everywhere. And we wanted to get down into the Delta because what the government, the junta, was doing was not allowing international aid into the country. And they weren't being honest about what the situation was and how much damage had been caused. And they also simultaneously wanted to run a referendum on giving the junta more power.
Gosh.
So we went to...
Because all the power's not enough.
Oh, yeah, exactly. All the power and all the money and all the everything is not enough. And so we... It took a day to find someone that would take us, because people risk their lives to enable journalists to tell these stories. And we hid on the back of a truck under all these, like, sacks and cardboard boxes, and there were, like, cockroaches and all sorts of things. So we had to hide there for, like, 8 hours while this guy drove us through checkpoints, got to this little village on the river, and then he disappeared for like two more hours. And you're like, oh my God, we're going to get arrested. We're going to get deported. This is a nightmare. Came back, put us in this little fishing, like a canoe, sort of like a waka, shaped like a waka. And took us out into the Delta. And as soon as we got out of the truck, people were like, you know, because you're white, basically, and you're not supposed to be there. And we hid in the bottom of this truck, went out into this little village and found this family who had like half a sack of rice and, you know, 20 odd mouths to feed. And what was crazy about it was that the military had been there to tell them that they still had to vote in the referendum. And I just remember feeling so angry and devastated for these people who had lost family members, their homes, their rice paddy fields, and to have a government junta that's not coming and bringing you food or allowing enough food into the country, but is coming to tell you that you have to vote to keep them in power. And these people, you know, through the translator, obviously saying, oh, they have to, you've got to ask questions really carefully, right? Because you don't want to, people speak in code a lot, basically. And he says, yes, that's all he can say because people are listening. And you realise that even in these far reaches of these devastated rice paddy fields, that there's a spy in this room. And yet people still trust you to tell their stories.
Wow.
I mean, it's an extraordinary privilege to go those places and to be entrusted and the risks people take to share with you. Yeah.
It's incredible when you think of these experiences around the world that are so far from our lived experience here.
Yeah.
And being able to tell those stories is huge because it could, you know, and hopefully will create positive change in those spaces. What do you do when you're in that situation? Because one of the things I'm thinking of as you're talking to me is how do you ensure the safety of these people when you leave? And I remember doing a story about West Papua. And the person I interviewed came to New Zealand, and when they went back, they were arrested because they had come to New Zealand to talk about what was happening in West Papua and the influence and genocide that the Indonesian government was championing there. And I just wonder how do you feel when leaving these spaces?
Oh, really? All of those things, all of the above, you know, it's an enormous responsibility. And when we left Myanmar, our fixer was arrested.
Wow.
And he was in prison for about 8 months. And that sits with you for a long, long time. Mm. And for those villages, you're very careful. Like any time in a situation like that, I always censor what actually goes in the story. Because, like, they know that there are journos around and people are talking to journos. So you have to, like, I pull back from the comments that go in the story because you don't want that person to be put at risk or in danger.
Mm-hmm.
So you tell, like, only as much as is necessary to put the idea across, you know, and then you do the piece to camera where you're like, bah, 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 bah,
bah, you when know. You say it.
Yeah. Because you have to. You have that responsibility.
Have you ever gone back? Because, of course, you know, once stories come out, they sort of get a bit of an idea that you're a journalist and they see your face and possibly recognise your name.
Oh, well, we had to do, like, pixelated piece to cameras.
Wow.
And we didn't key any of the... Yeah, so now it's like, oh, yeah, I went to Myanmar. It's like, is that you, that blob with the arms and legs? But, yeah, I mean, that's how serious it was. And, like, I had other colleagues that were... They were in, like, a two-hour car chase. The police were trying to get them and they just wouldn't stop and they just kept going and going and going. I mean, it was... Yeah, it was really... It was trippy. It was, like, an entire week just, like... having heart palpitations, basically.
And
how
do you get out? Do you hit, like, I mean, you're not just going to rock up to the airport and fly out.
Yeah.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
You don't have to, like, cross to another border or, do something. I'm thinking about the movies now.
Well, I mean, you couldn't have, like, I couldn't have a notepad. I couldn't keep people's numbers written down. You know, you had to memorize things.
Wow.
You had to have, like, a cover story. So I was there with a producer who was actually normally based out of the Jerusalem Bureau. And so we were pretending to be a couple and we were taking photos of each other and selfies and all these kinds of things in front of monuments. And so you would intersperse the journalism with pretending to be a tourist, like buying crap at the markets and, things like that. Yeah, it's... And then you leave. And I think they, you know, they're not stupid. They know that unless they catch you kind of red-handed, there's not much they can do. But the worst that was going to happen to us was that we were deported because they don't want the bad look of incarcerating foreign journalists because they incarcerate their own people without repercussions, you know, and had arrested, you know, our fixer, and we had lots of contact with his wife and supported them financially and eventually got them out after about 8 months. But it's a real, it's a really eye-opening experience because you do think our privilege in Aotearoa is just, it's a fluke of birth, right? That could have been us. It could be me in a past life or me in a future life, you know, and what would you do to try to improve your people's situation? And would you take those risks? And for most of us, the answer is yes.
Tell me about your time in South Africa, because that's, I mean, you've You've been to some really interesting countries and spaces, but that have been really politically powerful places,
yeah.
whether it's positive politics or negative politics.
Yeah.
What was South Africa like? Because you were there for, was it 6 years?
Yeah, 6 years. So I wanted, that's funny because it's that whole thing of like, I wanted to work in media and so did that. And then I was like, hold on a minute, I could be a reporter here. So I was like, push and push and push for a reporting job. And then after 6 years was offered this correspondence role in Southern Africa. And it was fantastic. I mean, South Africa is an extraordinary country with an extraordinary history and consequently the most extraordinary people, some of them that you'll ever meet. I mean, the hardship and the sacrifice that people have experienced and endured and come out the other side of. You know, and it's still obviously a work in progress, but man, there's a lot of stuff back there that to work through. It was a privilege, an enormous privilege. And I was essentially there because Mandela was nearing the end of his life, and there was this real paranoia around missing it. So they put two correspondents there. So I was the second correspondent there. And because somebody always had to be in South Africa, because it's like, this is when it happens, is going to be a global event. And so I spent the first kind of year absolutely terrified that this iconic leader was going to pass away, because I thought, I haven't been here long enough. I don't understand the country. I don't understand the people enough to do this story justice to my level of satisfaction. And so, I read his book, like Long Walk to Freedom, literally three times. I have notebooks and the personality, if we talk about his schooling, if we talk about this, it's going to be like this, like crib sheets, screes and screes of crib sheets. But had the wonderful joy in the process of speaking to many of his colleagues and also people that I worked with who'd seen apartheid in action and who'd been part of the uprising against apartheid, who'd had family members imprisoned. You know, my cameraman's mother was imprisoned. Wow. His brother was on the run during the youth uprising in the 1970s. They lived on the run. And, I mean, the entire country has PTSD, really. But to be there in that space when he passed away, when Mandela passed away, was just one of the biggest privileges of my life, really. And I was only 3 months in when I had it was a really difficult story to be on and a very traumatic one for lots of reasons as well, because I was fresh, you know, really fresh to the country. I'd only been in South Africa for about 3 months when these miners' strikes started in the Platinum Belt in Northwest, which is only about 2-3 hours from Joburg. And so we were going up there because, you know, people work in mines, and they were, during apartheid, a lot of black people were sent back to their, like, so-called homelands, right? So you go out there and you live, you know, everybody lives in their own different tribal area, basically, and you needed effectively a passport to be in your own country. So you were sent to the Eastern Cape, and if you wanted to come to Joburg, you needed, like, a passbook that said that you were allowed to come to Joburg to work in the mine or whatever you were going to do. And so one of the legacies of that is that the splitting up of many families. Family stays in the rural areas. The men in general were in the mines, because it's an incredibly rich country in terms of mineral and metal wealth. And so these miners were striking for better pay. They're in the Platinum Belt, you know, mining this. And I have a platinum ring, and I thought, oh my goodness, this is where this stuff comes from. It's off the back and sweat and blood of black South Africans. And you have these awful moments of checking your own privilege, right? And so we went into the space, and there had been a number of killings because there was tension between some mining unions, and we'd been going for 2 or 3 days, and then we thought on the third day let's go because it feels like something is building here, and so we went, and there was like. Overnight, the police had just flooded the area, and it was like their equivalent of a special task force, like kind of like armed defenders squad type look, like with the full get up with the like armored vehicles as well. They call them Nyalas. They're like a people moving tank. So had a few of those in helicopters, which was totally different to the day before, and was like, okay, so. Obviously something is happening today. And so we were told we'd been down by the miners and the police were like, you know, you've got to go and you've got to stand over there. And I'm like, why? And he goes, we're going into a tactical phase. I'm like, what does that mean? He's like, it's a tactical phase. If you don't stand over there, I can't guarantee your safety. And I'm like, are you using live rounds? And he didn't say anything. Got in the vehicle. And so everyone stands where they're supposed to for like 30 seconds and it's like, I'm not standing here. Mm-hmm. And so these men who'd been striking were sitting on like a, they call it a kopet, but it's like a rock on the flat, like a mini ears rock kind of thing, that kind of structure. And they came down and then the police strung out all this like barbed wire. And then kind of, some of them moved towards, some of them ran away, and they like boxed them in. And then there was all this crackle of gunfire. And then silence. And smoke and silence. And I went with my cameraman up to the front. And there were men on the ground and, sorry. It didn't register because that's not supposed to happen.
Yeah.
You have obviously experienced some extreme trauma by witnessing these sorts of things that many of us will only ever see recreated in movies and so don't have the sense of reality and don't have the true understanding of what it is to be in a space when innocent people are being murdered in front of your eyes.
Because they want to get paid enough to feed their families.
Yeah. How do you deal with that?
Not very well, for the most part. I mean, you're an inherent part of your job is to be there and to bear witness to whatever it is, good or bad. And honestly, I think I was in shock. And they kept pushing me. I remember in the lives, just like, what's happened? You know, have they used live rounds? It's like, they said they might use live rounds, but like, I didn't go on the offensive in the lives. I really stuck to what I knew, which was they said they were going to use live rounds. Clearly, some people have been seriously injured. Some are dead. I did a count myself, which is a pretty horrible experience. Mm. You know, I could see 16 on the ground and then some, like, who had clearly tried to run away, who were, like, kind of halfway over fences and through bushes and things like that. Some had still been moving. I talked about how, you know, so I just went into full reporter mode, basically. The ambulance didn't come for an hour and a half. Nobody on the scene, you know, the police clearly didn't have any medics. Nobody made any attempt to try and save lives. They let them bleed to death. Mm. And there was gunfire afterwards. And what eventuated was that after a commission of inquiry and all these things, you know, that always happen, is that they had followed men that had run away and had shot them, either some while they were trying to surrender and others were shot in the back. And you have to go into a place inside you when you're in those spaces where I'm not going to serve anyone by falling apart. I have to make sure to do justice to the travesty of justice, that I have to do that as a journalist and as a reporter. And it was only days afterwards when something happened. I needed to go and get something. I had gone back to Joburg by this stage and I had to go to a shopping centre. There's a big shopping centre in Sandton, and I remember being on the escalator and just seeing all these people with their shopping bags, and everyone was just buying, you know, it was like unicorns and rainbows, and just wanting to scream, like, are you kidding me? This is up the road. Like, why isn't everybody there? Why isn't everybody doing something? And just kind of like, not fainting, but just sort of like, really my heart was racing, and I just felt like I had to sit down, because you just, that's when that shock wears off and it sinks in. But it, if you think about it, you can bring it back.
Mm. How do you, and you may not, but are there parts of your Māori heritage and your Māori culture that help you in these situations and post this mahi?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah. I think being Māori helps in that you feel an inherent connection to other Indigenous people.
Mm.
And you have, like, in your DNA, a compassion and a level of understanding that other kinds of reporters and broadcasters aren't going to have. Because, I mean, you can't make any comparisons, obviously, between the experience here and of colonisation and the experience in South Africa. But I think I found it easier to connect with people. Yeah, and also in a strange way, in what, you know, under apartheid were called coloured people, which is mixed race people, around the sort of Cape Town area, I felt kind of at home. It was really weird because you're in, like, still quite divided communities, you know, with some in shacks and some in just really low, poor quality housing, but they've got all the same. Well, they've all seen Once Were Warriors, for starters. Oh, New Zealand! Oh, it's, no. But it resonates in that community because there are big issues around domestic violence and alcohol abuse.
Wow.
And I felt like more at home in that environment than I did in other spaces in South Africa. Mm.
When you look at your career, and your career is nowhere near over, you're back here in Aotearoa working with the Sunday program and telling the stories of us here back at home. When you look and reflect back on the years and the experiences that you've had overseas, and then and some of those huge moments in our history that you've been able to cover, and then coming home, what do you see as the most important thing in your job, in your role, and in who you are?
Oh, I think it's funny because, I know, storytelling seems such a cliche, but I think it is constant learning and discovery is what actually drives me. And whether that was in broadcasting or not is kind of, the storytelling part of it is the side part of it almost.
Mm.
I think what's really, oh, sorry, I've lost my train of thought. Can you ask that question again?
I can ask that question again. We'll just cut back into the I lost my train of thought bit. So what do you see as one of the most, you know, important parts of your job, or what has been an important part of your job?
I think being authentic in your storytelling is an important, crucial part of the job, and listening to people. It's not going in with an idea of, oh, yes, I read this, or, oh, yes, I saw this, and how am I going to do this, and, you know, not shaping it in your head before you get there, and really listening. And that's the wonder of particularly daily news, that you can be in situations where you can, you just absorb, like you try and not, it's not only about what you find out in the interviews, it's about all the little conversations and the interactions and the corridor you have along the side. It's your gut kind of reaction to situations. It's like, it's the feel and the spirit of it sometimes. It's what's not said, you know, and being able to kind of draw on all of those little threads, which are tangible and intangible, and put something together, is the beauty of journalism, I think.
You are a mama, and you've brought your whānau home. What was important about bringing your whānau home and raising your tamariki here?
I think from the moment I got hapu, it was like the clock was ticking on our return to Aotearoa. Because oddly enough, neither of our whānau were moving to South Africa anytime soon. So I was like, okay. Yeah, I left with my then boyfriend, Cornell, and we came home husband and wife. I should say that. We solidified while we were away our desire to explore our Māoritanga, because we had lived in all these places and we travelled all these places, and there's like 11 official languages in South Africa. People at least speak two. You know, some, I worked with one guy called Prince Maimela, and he spoke 6 languages.
Wow.
Extraordinary. And you kind of think, God, I've travelled the world, and people say, oh, where are you from? Oh, you know, Aotearoa, New Zealand, and oh, you know, are you Māori? Oh, yeah. And you'd have like a little bit of a conversation. You're like, what does that mean to me? And increasingly what became important was that we learn te reo. And so, you know, we had awa in Joburg and then Winiata, and it was like, how are we going to do this? You know, we need a strategy. And so the easiest way was that it was kind of through them, you know. And so we thought, let's go back early enough that we can get them into some kind of full immersion. It just felt like the planets aligned, because then I got this fantastic role on Sunday, and Miriam Akamo is the host of Sunday. And in our first conversation, she's like, what are you going to do with Awa? And I'm like, oh, I was thinking about this. And she's like, oh, well, you should come and meet so-and-so and so-and-so. And she took us to those spaces and introduced us to everyone. And, you know, if I hadn't have got that job, and if I hadn't had that baby at that time, and then they wouldn't have done that. And, you know, it just felt like everything was like it, that I believe in that kind of, you know, planets and stars aligning, like, oh, this is all meant to be.
And it's always amazing wahine who help us in those
spaces. Interesting, isn't it? So, yeah, we put them into Te Puna Reo Manawanui, which is where we live in Te Atatū, and now Awa is at Te Kura Kaupapa Māori or Huani Waititi. And that's been such a wonderful thing. And I feel like in some ways everything that happened overseas was kind of like a parallel universe. And now we're doing what we would have done, but just kind of a bit delayed, I suppose. So my husband went to Takiura. He did a year immersion course, because we, you know, it's like, I mean, we're intelligent people, but you're kind of thinking, oh, yeah, well, and then we'll do some reo lessons, and oh, yeah, like, shazam. And now we're back, and now I'm going to learn Māori, and it's going to be like Guy on Espina, but better. And it's totally not. Yeah, it's like, oh, wow, like, underestimated all of this. And you know, the whole kaupapa was it's you need to have reo in the home. And so we thought, well, I'm doing, you know, Sunday. My husband wasn't working at that point yet. And so I was like, well, this is kind of the time, isn't it? So he went off and did a year immersion. He's continued through Te Wānanga Aotearoa. I'm doing my first year Te Wānanga Aotearoa now and am blessed at working at TVNZ that Scotty Morrison runs some reo classes.
Those bloody Morrisons.
I know.
Don't we love them?
Oh, my
don't
goodness.
We love to hate
them? Don't you just want to bottle them and and sell it or something? Yeah, and so and those reo classes started like 3 months after we came back, and yeah, so now we have this like mostly it's still English at home, unfortunately, which is all my fault. But the boys are fluent, and all my three boys are fluent, and yeah.
When you think about the world and all the Indigenous people that you've met in the different countries that you've travelled to, what does it mean or what does it look like for you to be an Indigenous Māori woman in the world today?
It looks like the world's your oyster, to be honest, because I feel like our time has come. It feels like there's a real movement here in Aotearoa that's maximising and in some spaces just introducing te reo into more environments. For me, being Māori was only ever an advantage in Al Jazeera particularly, only ever an advantage because I could be the voice of, you know, I remember a story in the UK, a British reporter went off to do about upoko being, tupuna being returned from a museum and being able to just enlighten her a little bit is like you can have, you don't need to be like solving all the world's problems, you know. It's about making all those incremental little changes and introducing different spheres of knowledge to people who either don't have them because of ignorance or just don't have them. You know, if you can be that one person that says, hey, have you thought of looking at it like this, then there's enormous power in all those small actions, I think.
Who is an Indigenous woman that has inspired you on your journey?
This is really tricksy, hey? I mean, there's been many, you know, if I think my childhood, obviously my mama, and she was of that generation, you know, they didn't learn reo, they don't have reo in her generation, so I don't know how she would feel about being described as an Indigenous woman, but that's how I see her, because her whakaaro is very Māori. Her connection to her whenua, to her tupuna, to her whānau is very Māori. A very loving, patient, kind woman. In my current kind of space, I mean, you know, obviously Mariama has held a lot of space for many Māori women and for Māori voice and identity in a difficult mainstream environment for a long time. You've got the Morrisons, the Stacey and Hinarangi Forbes doing fearless journalism. And really, you know, I guess we're all conscious that there's so much mahi has come before where we are now. And you feel like you've got to be the one that still helps to kind of drive all of that kōrero forward that opens up more spaces for Māori women. I met an extraordinary woman last year called Cindy Kero, and she is a... She was Pro Vice Chancellor Māori at Auckland University. She's a former Children's Commissioner. She headed the government's welfare advisory group, and she grew up just outside of Whangarei. So she's also a Northland girl. And I totally fangirled her when I met her. I was like, oh, such a big brain, such a big heart, you know. But, you know, she's dedicated her entire life to the betterment of Māori. and in a very gentle, even voice, you know, voice of reason, but has always been a champion for the underdog. And I think it's so inspiring to meet women like that, yeah, who are doing all the real mahi in a way.
That's awesome. We've come to our last pātai. And I have to say, you've done great on the other side of this job. It's always funny turning the tables on a journalist and putting them on the other side of the microphone. What is your hope for the future of Indigenous women?
I have two hopes. One, that we have reached the peak generation of women that feel... have to cope with language trauma and whakamā about connecting to our Māori side and te ao Māori. I hope that has peaked and that we're in the clear and it's only, you know, on the up, because that's something that I've struggled with. And my other hope is that we are in every room. You know, we're in the boardrooms, we're in the dental clinic, we're in all the schools, that we're in every room. And we are in leadership positions, because I feel like all these conversations that we have and the issues that we talk about in journalism and media, you know, are long-standing ones, but maybe that's just because the right people haven't been in charge. Maybe it's time a Māori woman was at the helm.
That's right. Tautoko. Thank you so much for sharing just an insight into your story. And for sharing some of those experiences that you had throughout your career. It has been a privilege listening to them, and a real eye-opener, I think, for many of us to think about our privilege in the world and to think about what happens beyond our borders. I am really looking forward to seeing the story that you've been working on, because we were just talking about it this morning, that long-form television broadcasting journalism is quite...
marathon, not a sprint.
And making these things. So looking forward to seeing you more often on the Sunday program with some amazing stories from Aotearoa. So tēnā koe.
Tēnā koe.
Before you go, did you know we have a Nuku shop? We sell Nuku kākahu, clothing, whakakai, earrings, and gifts for mama. And we sometimes stock the products of our Nuku 100 wahine. You can check it out at www.nukuwoman.co.nz/hoko. 100% of all profits made in the Nuku store go directly into amplifying the voices of kick-ass Indigenous wahine. Check it out today.